Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's February 5th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams who want to deploy their software faster use Terraform. We do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help your team release your software faster. Just book a meeting at cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and we'll show you how modern infrastructure gets deployed. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format's very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos or our Terraform modules, this is a great place to ask. And for those on the recording, we do host these calls live. Don't miss out. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse in a few hours, where we'll post a recording of this session. So with that said, let's see, what do we got this week? All right, looks like I had already advanced, so you got my preview here. So yeah, first announcement was the Cube Resource Orchestrator, which is a collaboration between, I think, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, as the end-all be-all replacement for Helm. And it's pretty interesting when you take a look at how it works. So basically, with the KRO, you can define your own custom kind of resource that is parameterized. That kind becomes a custom resource itself. So we can define a new kind that we call a web app. So just like there are deployments, pods, and jobs, you can define now something totally arbitrary like a web app. And that itself will be composed of a bunch of other Kubernetes resources. So I'll show you an example of what that looks like here. So if we go like this example of a web stack. So the fundamental custom resource is called a resource graph definition. And then this here can define a bunch of other resources under the hood. I think this example is a little bit more complicated than it needed to be. I think they could have done an easier one where it's shown as being composed of like deployments and pods and just the other things. In this example, I believe it's being composed of yet other KROs. So you can see how this can build up a complete architecture with these types of resources. And these are then the parameters that it accepts. Then you can see how easy it is to define it. Where we now invoke our new web stack, where we now like provision this custom resource called a web stack, and we pass in some parameters to it. Very nice solution, if you ask me. It's ripe. All we need to do is now stick this in a Helm chart, and we're done. Joking. Has anyone already played around with KRO yet? So I think that what's nice about it is it doesn't have all the crazy Go templating to create the resources. It's composable, much, you can almost think of all those little pieces, those graph definitions as components, and then those components can incorporate other components and so forth. Nothing else. We'll move on. So I don't know what led me to this. Ah, yes. I was looking at one of HashiCorp's projects, and I noticed that a lot of the files had just been modified within the last 6 months, changing license headers. And I was like, oh no, is one of the things we depend on now changing license as well? So I looked at the PR and then I saw that the PR was auto-generated, courtesy of the MPL licensed copyright tool written by HashiCorp. Looks like they're actively maintaining it. New release just 2 weeks ago. This is kind of convenient, actually. If you want to stamp all of your files with the standard copyright headers that indicate what license that file is licensed under, then this is the tool to do it. And I think it can even open up a pull request and do that for you. Plus, since projects continuously add new files, and it's a hard thing to get developers to consistently add those headers, you can use this as a GitHub action to automatically add copyright headers to all files in our project to ensure that the copyright is easily understood for parts of a project. So obviously, this is something that has come into use for HashiCorp when they changed their license. Now, what is interesting is this is 2 years ago. It'd be interesting to see what they were doing 2 years ago, because the fork was only about a year ago. Matt, if you've been talking, you've been muted this whole time.
It showed I was unmuted. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, this happened to you last week, I remember.
Yeah, that's weird. I was just asking, did you say that this is, oh no, oh, this is MPL licensed.
Yeah, this
This.
is itself MPL license, so it's fine.
I thought you said it was BSL licensed at first, and I was like, really?
Oh, no. This obviously came into play when they changed Terraform.
I got all that part. I just thought you said that this was also BSL licensed, and I was like, eh, that's kind of crappy of them.
So I think this is interesting. I think it's something we might want to consider leveraging.
Out of curiosity, does the copyright repo make use of the copyright package to copyright all their files with MPL?
That'd be interesting. Let's see if they are dog fooding it here.
It's usually the first two lines of the file, like at least in
Well,
on
yeah, I was
all the
just looking at the
HashiCorp.
workflow itself. If you can set patterns which you want to copyright of files or so forth. But I'm glad you asked, because that jogged another memory. So Suzuki is one of these awesome open source developers out there, and he's been helping us out a little bit on the side with Atmos. And one of the things he just did was turn us on to a new service that I hadn't heard about. Let's see if I remember where. Yeah, autofix. Yeah, what's this workflow here? Autofix. Yeah. So in our gosh, where to begin? So at Cloud Posse, we have hundreds of repositories. We receive a lot of pull requests from contributors. And there's one of the big annoyances when you do open source is that all the contributions come from forks, and how and the person who forked can have other weird permissions on their repo, and trying to do programmatic commits back to a fork is really hard. And you cannot use just the default GitHub token. Because if you use just the default GitHub token, yeah, I think it can update the fork, but then no other checks run. So now you have this problem where you don't get any of your other validation automation to go. So one of the common workarounds is you use pull request target, but then if for any reason secrets are exposed there, then those secrets can leak. So let's just say that it is tricky if you want to auto fix pull requests from contributors on open source. So autofix.ci is a GitHub app that you can install either on a repo or for an org. It is a paid app that is free for open source. So if you manage open source projects, you can leverage this right away. You just set it up by creating a workflow that has a name, autofix.ci. It has to be exactly that name after you have installed this workflow. And then any jobs or tasks in that workflow that you add, it will automatically commit and push those up to the branch for you, leveraging the permissions of the GitHub app. So your credentials are safe and sound, and you don't have to worry about creating another app just for this one use case. There are other alternatives. We've implemented most of them at Cloud Posse already. This just was just another nice one that was so easy to get up and running. So in our case, the way we are using it here in this auto fix is we are automatically running GoFunked on all of our Go files to normalize the formatting of them. We're automatically running GoMod Tidy to keep that file up to date and reduce the issue with merge conflicts on the GoMod and GoSum files. And anything else, like historically, we've regenerated the README on behalf of contributors. This is something that could go in this workflow. So I figured that would get your attention, Matt.
Are y'all going to be rolling that out to the suite of
Well,
Terraform modules?
maybe we'll bring, so we've done two things on that as it relates to our Terraform modules. Historically we did this for a very long time and we always did it. Then there was it was brought to our attention that the way we were doing it was not secure. So we just got rid of it. Then what we did was now we just do it after merge to main. So we don't have to worry about it being up to date or not when the pull request is merged. However, there's no harm in doing it. So maybe with this, we can reintroduce it now since it's a relatively easy thing to do.
Yeah, and I mean, even if we do it after merge to main, we still have tests in CI that it require that we, README is up to date and
Those should have
like
been disabled, but are you getting those? Is
maybe
it?
I'm out of the loop. Maybe
Yeah, those should have been disabled. Those were
I'm
via batch.
probably telling people to run, make README all the time when maybe I don't need to anymore. I didn't know that we were doing it in CI after before the release. But this is cool. Just generally, this is a good utility to know about. I'm glad I caught this one.
And another cool thing, just to promote it some more, I think Matt, you were Gowie, you were the one who turned me on to it, was Aqua. Aqua is a really elegant, small, lightweight package manager that lets you install your dependencies the same way, whether you're on Windows, Mac, and running in CI on Windows, etc. It can install basically any package that is distributed via GitHub. Maybe there are other sources as well. So as you can see, Suzuki updated this to use Aqua to install some of these packages as well.
Yeah, Aqua's awesome. Just another plus one.
That reminded me. Remind me about something that came and went as fast as it entered my mind. It'll hit me later. All right, next update was this was a nice one written by Zach. Thank you so much for sharing this, Zach. So Zach, he's been in our community forever. He decided to do a POC on Atmos and kick the tires and see how it worked. Learn the concepts and so forth. Zach has been a long time task file user, and it really loves using task file. Task file is like a modern make alternative based around YAML. So if you like YAML and you like make, check out task file. So he wanted to see what's all the hype around Atmos. He spent a few days working on that and coming up with an architecture leveraging it. So if you want to see somebody else's take on Atmos and how they found it, also, the pros and cons that they found or some interesting gotchas, check it out. It's pretty favorable to Atmos. And then I think the cons are legitimate, and many of them we are working on addressing. So.
I'll also say if you like Makefile and YAML, you should also seek therapy.
Doesn't help, man. I'm just saying. So.
don't know. Neither of them are among my favorite tools for sure, but I live with them.
I can't unlearn make file nomenclature and
That's true.
nuances. So, yeah.
And then, well, so Zach, I saw you're on a tear here. I saw you wrote another blog post, which was also really interesting. I didn't know you had written this one until I was reading Anton's newsletter. I had called out when reading your other post on Atmos how you were using encrypted state committed to Git. For your POC there. And I thought that was really interesting because there hasn't been yet too much written about using encrypted state and the opportunities it opens with potentially using Git for some of the state storage under some circumstances. So anything you'd like to highlight from the article you wrote up here trying to use encrypted state and Git with OpenTofu?
Yeah, I probably didn't put the danger sign like large enough at the beginning, maybe, that you probably shouldn't store this kind of stuff in state, and Git to begin with. But the whole premise was, like I home local labs and stuff like that, I'm not spinning out, S3 buckets for that kind of state, for one-offs and things like that. So, how can I securely keep what is essentially a small amount of JSON secure, locally. Now, in this particular example, I actually went through and did it all in Terraform with SOPs and age first. And there's a multiple branches in this the example repo for this that show sort of a, my horrible Terraform abilities, I guess, maybe. I only scratched out as fast as possible. It wasn't like meant for production deployments, but for doing like local clusters, I did it all in Terraform first with local state and how you would do that in an encrypted way, and then as well with the Tofu encrypted state. And that Tofu encrypted state's awesome. It like makes it so you don't really have to remember pre-commit, scripts and things like that. And if it's as secure as it seems. And there's no, major flaws in how the encryption's being done. It's pretty solid, so.
Yeah, that part definitely seems solid. Storing it in GitHub like makes me shiver. Like the merge conflict possibility there like makes me want to
I mean,
puke.
if you're only the only person ever running it
Yeah. If
yourself, you're
you're
doing
a
it as like for
single,
bootstrap code,
I agree.
then
Yeah. If you're a
yeah.
single person and you're the only one working on it, yes. But don't do
That's
that
the only
if
use
anyone
case,
else is
really.
working with you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't collaborate with like local state. It doesn't work that way. So yeah.
Very interesting. So I see in Maine you landed on task file.
We're using my old stuff, so.
Got it. Got it. Cool. Well, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, I will. I'll still use Atmos, man. I'll try to get into using it for tasks, but I don't know if I'll ever make it my main driver. I'm sorry. I don't want to
It's
insult
all
you, but.
right. I understand. Don't have delusions, but it would be interesting to learn from a usability standpoint what is missing. Because personally, I think I would like it more than task file with the new changes that are coming out. Maybe not all of them are there yet, but I like just the I like What I don't like about using task file is it still feels like using make, but in a in YAML. What I like about using Atmos is it feels like a custom CLI. It feels like a CLI with arguments, with subcommands that you can specify, and it feels just more Unix friendly in that sense.
You sold me. I'll have to give it a run through and do
And
another
what I'm
article or
talking about
something.
are the custom command features of Atmos. So things that we don't support yet is like pipelining of like in task file, you can have a dependency. Like if I run this task, it has these other three tasks as a dependency. So run those first. So we don't have that concept with custom commands at this time. You could call them directly, but I think that's something we want to consider in the, later on this year at some point, maybe. All right. So that was Atmos. And then we had this. This was something cool that Matt Galloway discovered. Sometimes you don't know that you wanted something only for somebody to share it. And then you realize, oh, that sounds kind of interesting. And what's interesting to me about it is that somebody else had the same problem. So, what is Terra Schema? So, for those that don't know, Terraform supports two types of files to describe your infrastructure. You can write it in HCL. Those are all the files that you're familiar with the .tf extension. Or you can write it in JSON, formatted in a structure similar to, or that reduces to, HCL. These are files typically called .tf, .json. You can also have var files, and your var files can be written in HCL format or JSON format. So Terra Schema was written to validate those var files specifically, match the schema of the Terraform code itself without having to run Terraform plan. And why that is nice is when you run Terraform plan, you have to have credentials. So what if you're building a lightweight, in this case, they describe a use case here of a form, they're building a form to accept some inputs from the user to provision Terraform code. How do they validate those inputs are compatible with the inputs, the variables of the Terraform root module itself. So this is what Terra Schema does. It generates a JSON schema based on the variable inputs of a module so that you can validate some JSON against that, specifically like a var file. Curious, Matt, what led you, Matt Galloway, you had posted about this, I think. And then you ended up finding the solution on your own. What were you exploring, or what led you down this path? I'm just curious, Matt Galloway.
Yeah, I had a whole thing with this where basically optional within Terraform and Tofu makes it so that you can have a type definition for an incoming object. But if you don't include some of those optional keys, then the resulting optional arguments are included into that object, right? And then if you try and merge that with another object, then you can end up overwriting things that you don't want to overwrite. I don't know if that's sufficiently describing the problem, but I basically ended up, posting about that in the Open Tofu Slack, chatted with Martin Atkins for a while on that, and got the answer that, hey, yeah, there's not a way around that today. My suggestion is to use any. Accept any input and then validate within Tofu or within the root module itself or the child module that you're consuming that value in. And I ended up using a separate provider, a JSON schema provider that basically can validate a an object against a given JSON schema. And
Oh, gotcha.
solves the problem in kind of a ugly way. I don't really, yeah, I don't know. I wish there was a little bit better support at the like Terraform tofu layer to like support, hey, I want to take in this object, it should look like this, but any of the given keys, if I don't include them, then don't include them in the resulting object. But it's a little bit complicated to implement, supposedly.
You can do those validations with Atmos too. We support OPA and JSON schema and many other things. So you can do that in there as well.
So this was for a Terraform child module that I'm accepting this value in that does it's you know anybody can use it. It's a open source child module, so it's not something I can say, hey, go and use Atmos 100% of the time and go
That
that way.
makes
But
sense.
yeah. Anyway, I just saw this in Anton's newsletter at the bottom of like open source
Oh,
projects,
really?
and it's fascinating because it's just like, yeah, the I was just running into this last week, and he shares this from Hewlett Packard, which is funny, it's from Hewlett Packard, by the way. Like from HP. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. It just goes to show, though, how often multiple people are encountering the same kinds of problems at around the same time,
Yeah.
and approaching the problem in similar ways, like Leibniz, Descartes, or calculus.
To be, this past like month or two, I've come to the realization that, hey, we're all solving the problem, similar problems. We're all going about it in completely different ways, particularly in the like infrastructure as code world. And it feels like our best practice is somebody else's anti-pattern, and their best practice is our anti-pattern. That is a very recurring theme in my like recent weeks. Discussion topic, but yeah.
No, you've shared some of those. I think that's interesting. There was a post you were talking about recently. What was that one on? Oh,
Oh, the
it
open source one. Yeah.
Do you build it or use open source? Build it in-house or do it open.
Yeah, there's that. There's the idea of the like non-dry root modules. So like copy and pasting your, dev stage prod environments like wholesale to create different environments and manage infrastructure. We always recommend against that. There's some people who live and die by that as their, way of doing things. And some people are like, workspaces are trash. You should never use workspaces. There's a ton of different examples. I mean, the founder of Terra Team, Malcolm, he's, writing right now a project called Terralith, which is about, he just wrote a blog post on this. I just shared it with my team. I'm like trying to think through, I like get where he's coming from. This is a discussion topic. I don't know if we'll end up bogging down your entire your announcements. So maybe
I'm
after.
almost done, but
Yeah.
let's
Let's
circle
circle
back
back.
to some good topics there. All right, next one was obviously if you've been reading any news over the past 2 weeks, it's been overwhelmed with DeepSeek related announcements. The app is crashing, the app is online, it outperforms OpenAI, only costs $6 million, and yada yada yada. So it was really interesting to see also how quickly GitHub adopted it as one of the models that were supported in it. I haven't run too many experiments with it myself, other than testing the mobile app. Any thoughts on this one? I see Matt, you have something maybe.
Oh, my only thought is we're worried about TikTok, but no problem. Let's just run artificial intelligence models from China willy-nilly and not figure out what the hell they're doing under the hood. But yeah, I don't know. I've seen a lot of I've seen a lot of things on both sides of this. Yeah, good point, Zach. I don't think that you're right. I don't think the model itself is a threat, but the website might be. But I've seen a lot of hoopla about it. But at the end of the day, for almost every demo I've seen someone trying to do things, it's like an incremental improvement. None of these things are the 10x improvement that everyone thinks things are right in the beginning, or at least that's my opinion on having seen a bunch of people do shootouts with this versus other models.
You did say something that I never thought about before, the risk of it happening. Kind of, I don't know what the term would be, but malicious models, if you will, models that are by all intents fully functional and valid, and but somehow trained when it sees certain conditions that it does something. If we think about what was the Stuxnet virus, right? It did. It had infected millions and millions of computers that it did nothing to because they didn't meet the target criteria. But when it landed on the machines that were somehow connected with the centrifuges, then it kicked in and had a payload that it did something with. So it'd be in the same kind of way, AI could almost be as nefarious. You don't know when it's making those code suggestions. But it can be persistently trying to inject some kind of exploit basically into code suggestions. And I'm not talking about DeepSeek or anything. I'm just talking just in general. I never thought of the risk of that models could be compromised.
Yeah, and I think the more people rely on models, the more that that's like a risk of happening,
Yeah.
especially as like Google it seems to be slowly transitioning to ChatGPT it like on even in like non-tech people, and if people start to accept the things that models are coming out with as fact, then that becomes a big risk over time. I read an article not that long ago, and with a lot of that had a lot of examples. I can't remember where or I would quote it, but there was one where they were showing like how many of the models are, for lack of a better word, very woke. They give like liberally slanted or left-leaning slanted answers on a lot of social topics that people ask rather than just factual answers. So, that type of thing can, over time, if you slowly adopt it and slowly get more and more one way, there's a risk if people are relying on that as fact, and
That's true.
it's kind of
Totally
dangerous
pattern.
overall. That's just one example, but yeah.
I've experienced that as well.
Also fascinating to see how mega corporations like Microsoft navigate this, where at the same time they're supporting DeepSeek's implementation into GitHub, while
Right.
also OpenAI is actively, well, kind of attacking DeepSeek for stealing their data, which I'm sure they haven't stolen themselves.
Yeah, that's a there was a lot of what I don't how do you say the word
Playing both sides, so you always come out on
Freud.
top.
It's a German word or something. Schadenfreude.
Oh, Schadenfreude.
Say that again, Rashid.
Schadenfreude?
Yes.
It really does feel that way.
I think the less fancy way of saying it is they're throwing a bunch of crap against the wall and seeing what sticks. Like I don't think any like they're not gonna bet on any one horse until there's a clear winner, right? They can keep adjusting their bet anytime they want. They're gonna watch, the first three quarters of the race and see who's gonna win, and then they're gonna throw all their money into that basket.
And that came up quite recently where we were just trying to benchmark some AI performances in terms of how fast is ChatGPT if we host it in different data centers. And one of the weird things we came across, and it's documented publicly as well, apparently, where OpenAI is only available through Azure And if you want to use it, you can get it directly from OpenAI, or you can get it from Microsoft. Those are the only two official supporters. And it turns out if you get it from Microsoft, it's about almost twice as fast. And that blows your mind. How does that work? It's the same product, same solution, same pricing as well, I'm pretty sure, but it's just about twice as fast. It's like, I guess Microsoft guys know what they're doing in terms of optimizing their data centers, but at the same time, how does OpenAI not? That's their whole deal. How are they not as fast as a whole different company?
Well, the other weird part about that is, how are they not as fast as the company that invested like $1 billion in them, and part of that $1 billion was in compute credits to run it on the Azure in the Azure data center, right? They should be running it on the same exact stuff, which is just really weird. But
You're
yeah.
spot on. That's exactly it. They are both on Azure, and somehow Microsoft's offering is faster. I don't get that.
I just wonder if, though, that it's almost like, because it's a totally separate tenant or multiple other tenants, if you will, that it's not sharing the same compute infrastructure maybe as what they're using to host OpenAI and the public chat systems and so forth. That's just my sneaky suspicion.
They're running them in the same data center that they're running Hotmail in. They still have to keep up and running.
All right, let's see, next announcement. I've just been really, how do you say, what's the word? Impressed by the growth of Ghostie, which is Mitchell Hashimoto's side project turned passion project turned product that he's working on. For those that don't know, Mitchell left HashiCorp over a year ago at this point, I think, and has been feverishly working on Ghostie, a modern terminal emulator to replace, like if you've been using iTerm 2 or similar, this is one of those type of terminal emulators that's supposed to be a lot more performant. Some of the things that I think are really notable is in this 1.1.0 release is how many contributors have chipped in to making that release happen for a very early project. So obviously Mitchell's popularity within open source and pedestal through Twitter and or X and other systems have helped with this probably. Also, if you go join their Discord, I was really impressed. Like already a community with 32,000 registered members with 6,200 online. It seems like a pretty healthy project at this early stage. So, any updates? Anyone been using Ghosty yet or kicking the tires on it?
It is Zach. Yeah, dude, I did kick the tires on it, and it just seemed like another terminal to me, man. I didn't really get the mass appeal that everyone's heaping on it, but maybe it's just I'm not geeky enough to really fully appreciate it. So,
Yeah,
like a
I
fine
also,
wine, you got to know what you're looking for.
yeah, I was gonna say I also kicked the tires on it, and I came to the conclusion that Mitchell. It was cooler for Mitchell to build than it is for me to use. Like I enjoyed, like, because he built it in the open, right? So I enjoyed following the journey and learning about all the unique engineering problems that he hit and how he solved them and how he did all of these things and everything else. But at the end, when I used it, I don't have a compelling reason to switch off of Warp, which I've been using for a couple of years now. So.
Looks like Matt Gowey, you're also using Warp.
Yeah, I don't see the need to switch. I don't know, terminals. Everybody used iTerm 2 for a solid decade or whatever it was, and now it feels like there's a bunch of them, and I don't know how much you actually need out of a terminal emulator. So, yeah. It's interesting to see that there's 32,000 people in that community, though. It's mind-boggling. It's crazy.
Such a short time.
Yeah, impressive. It's purely must be
I guess it
attributed to
goes to
his following.
show how his approach, therefore, if we dissect that just for a minute, that was probably therefore very effective. Like Matt, you said he's been building this out in the open and been very vocal about some of those things, and I think people have therefore joined to be part of that journey.
Yeah, there actually are like 29,000 OnlyFans spam bots. That's what it is.
You had me there for a second.
Yeah,
All right.
it is a very large community.
The next announcement, we can dedicate today's office hours to Anton Babenko's weekly.tf newsletter. No, this was also something I caught on there. This was a comparison of the fun some of the recent functionality that's come out between BSL licensed Terraform and OpenTofu. I think there's been a lot of confusion in the community about what is supported where. So somebody's finally gone out and done the research and written up a very simple page here for that. So Matt, maybe with your explorations in tofu and everything you're doing, this would be helpful.
This must have just got updated, which is cool. I posted this on LinkedIn just last week and it got a little bit of buzz, which I'm happy about because it's nice to have a resource like this. I'll share, it's funny. I didn't know this previously, but Ned Balavance, his Ned in the Cloud blog shared, has something that he's keeping up to date that shows the difference between the two. But yeah, those add Terraform 1.10 new features and add 1.9 new features was those are brand new, which is cool. And yeah, it's useful to just see a side-by-side comparison. We're going to start to see them diverge more, and it'll be really needed because they're both working on different things. And I just learned about a new thing today that I didn't know was in Terraform. That I want to see in OpenTofu, and I asked the OpenTofu team, and they're releasing it in 1.10. So yeah, it's confusing because they're using the same semantic versioning system based from the same version, and they both have different things going out and different releases. It's really nice to have a resource that just kind of gives you apples to apples, and it helps. So it's cool.
What was the feature you uncovered?
Terraform 1.8, their release notes share that they added support for migrating resources from one type to another if a provider supports it. So what that means is a provider can get a refactor. The specific thing that I was looking this up for was a client who's doing a bunch of security group rules. And the new way of doing security group rules in the AWS provider is that there's a security group rule ingress and there's a security group rule egress. So you have to go from security group rule into two different types of resources that are named separately. And now the moved block supports that. So if you want to migrate those things, you can use the moved block in Terraform 1.8. And then in OpenTofu 1.10, that'll be released. It just got merged and they're planning on releasing it in the upcoming version. So, and it's a provider de developed thing. So a provider has to add support for that, but it's a thing that sounds like it's necessary. And I guess that would have been really helpful for S3, right? When
Yeah,
we all did the
exactly.
S3 migration, that would have been the use
Yeah.
case. So it's stuff like that, which is really nice to see the like quality of life improvements. And yeah, it's cool.
I thought it was interesting that security group thing. Jeremy Grodberg has a huge write-up on that one and the pros and cons of the different things.
I've run into that.
But I thought it was interesting. Lauren, I think he was not for the changes to the security group resource, and he liked it when they were all in one resource. I don't remember the architecture, though. I think he liked the atomic nature of it.
Okay. I didn't know that there was a. I've seen Jeremy's write-up. I didn't know that Lauren or anybody was against it, but Jeremy's write-up is thorough as always, which is yeah, it's always funny to see those things. Just let's all right, strap in for this wall of text that's very in depth. Impressive.
I would say all of these things keep leading me to believe that Terraform is the wrong tool for the job, but I don't know what is the right tool yet. It doesn't exist yet in my mind, but it is not Terraform slash OpenTofu.
I agree with you on that, but yeah, there's no alternative that does better. So this is the world we live in today.
Sounds like market opportunity.
There's definitely market opportunity.
Has anybody checked out Winglang?
Only just kicking the tires on it, not using it for anything real.
I didn't even do that. I saw it was built. I mean, early on, it was built on Terraform. Like they're just generating Terraform from your application code.
Oh, really?
And at that point, it's like you're gonna end up running Terraform. Somebody needs to manage that Terraform. Like, what am I getting here?
Yeah.
But
I think that's one of the things that gives Terraform so much inertia is that they've really programmatically defined much of the APIs and the web as we know it, if you will, and that's a big lift for any new solution to come across.
yeah. The provider ecosystem that they built by being first to market with a cross-cloud API, is nobody wants to take that on. And it to some degree or another, maybe, I don't know. Somebody needs to, maybe, but we'll see.
All right, my last announcement was just maybe to summarize some of the activity going on with Atmos over the past week or two. I'm working on the side on coming out with a more regular process for like a month in review for Atmos, since there is so much going on. I don't expect everyone to stay up to date with the improvements. We also do want to try and reduce some of the release velocity, combining some more pull requests, but more on that to come. We're going to need to refine some internal processes before we fully get there. So, bug fix, we just fixed something going on with vendoring. We were ignoring where we were rejecting URLs with ampersands in them. So one of the things we learned is you can really speed up Atmos vendoring if you add the parameter depth equals one to the GitHub URLs. Then it'll do a shallow clone of the repo, cutting it in half, the time it takes in half at least. So this is something we will probably look to add to Atmos automatically if it hasn't been specified. The next would be YAML, some optimizations to when we run template functions and YAML functions in Atmos. There were a lot of commands in Atmos that didn't need to have templating enabled and slowed them down or just flat out made them break. So, for example, Terraform workspaces don't need to support some of the Atmos functions, so we disabled those. When they run, so you can switch workspaces without having credentials to every location that Terraform outputs needed access to. Let's focus on maybe some more notable ones. A Redis storm. So one of the things we've solved with Atmos is this idea that